Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with the Wall Street Journal Business News for Wednesday, August 12, 2026. And here are today's business headlines. Home Depot chief executive to take medical leave of absence. A senior vice president and the chief financial officer will oversee operations during CEO Ted Decker's absence. By Sarah Nassauer and Kareth Vipers. New York City launches sweeping investigation into Polymarket and Kalshi. The probe targets the marketing practices of four prediction markets with operations in the city. By Kevin T. Dugan and Catherine Long. Risk report. Judge dismisses Adani fraud charges. Plus, flight tracking platform sues Kalshi over flight cancellation prediction markets, and trade groups seek to reel in FTC's AI ideology focus. By David Smigala. Financial Services Roundup Market Talk. Find insight on Hanover RE, ABN AMRO, Suncor, and more in the latest market talks covering financial services. Energy startup raises $750 million for rust-powered batteries. Form Energy's fundraising has surpassed $2 billion for batteries that can be continuously run for 100 hours. By Jennifer Hiller. The leadership lesson Zero's CEO learned from a tennis legend. By Lila McClellan. Here's our first article today, Home Depot chief executive to take medical leave of absence. Anne-Marie Campbell and Richard McPhail will provide oversight until CEO Ted Decker returns. By Sarah Nassauer and Kareth Vipers. Home Depot chief executive Ted Decker will take a temporary medical leave of absence, the company said Wednesday. Senior Vice President Anne-Marie Campbell and Chief Financial Officer Richard McPhail will oversee operations during his absence, Home Depot said. Decker, who took over the role in 2022 and is currently 63 years old, is expected to return in the next few months, according to a company statement. A company spokeswoman declined to share further details on the reason for Decker's medical leave. The company has not changed Campbell or McPhail's compensation structures related to their new positions, said the company in a financial filing. Campbell will oversee Home Depot's day-to-day operations, and McPhail will handle the company's financials, Home Depot said. Greg Brenneman, independent lead director, will serve as board chairman during Decker's leave. Home Depot and its competitor, Lowe's, have reported sluggish quarterly sales of late, amid a weak housing market and consumer caution around investing in big home improvement projects. Home Depot will report quarterly earnings next week. Sarah Nassauer writes about large retailers, including Walmart, Target, Costco, Home Depot, and Dollar General for the Wall Street Journal's Corporate Bureau in New York. Kareth Vipers runs breaking news for the Wall Street Journal in Europe, covering everything from U.S. politics and national affairs to technology, business, and world events. Our next story is New York City launches sweeping investigation into Polymarket and Kalshi. Probe targets the marketing practices of four prediction markets with operations in the city. By Kevin T. Dugan and Catherine Long. The New York City Council is investigating four prediction markets for alleged deceptive marketing practices and targeting minors, opening a new front in the bitter state-by-state legal war over prediction market regulation. City Council Speaker Julie Menin sent letters to Polymarket, Kalshi, Coinbase, and Gemini Titan, all of which have a presence in New York City, on August 11th, seeking answers about how the companies comply with consumer protection laws. In a letter addressed to Polymarket founder and chief executive Shane Copeland, Menon asked for details about Polymarket's promotional videos that appeared to depict fake trades and promoted insider trading on social media. Some of the advertisements have been targeted minors, Menon wrote. In June, Wall Street Journal, an analysis of more than 1,100 videos made by Polymarket creators, along with instructional materials and interviews with influencers who have worked with the company, found that 70% featured dummy sites the company used to film fake trades. Troubling news reports allege that Polymarket conspired with marketing agents and social media influencers to target young adults and thus potentially minors with false, deceptive, and unconscionable advertising, Menon wrote, according to a copy of the letter viewed by the journal. Gemini Titan didn't respond to a request for comment. Spokespeople for Polymarket and Kalshi said the companies look forward to engaging with the city council. In response to the journal's earlier reporting, Polymarket said it was committed to maintaining accurate, fair, and transparent markets, and that it would undertake an audit of its promotional content. More recently, the company has restructured its marketing team, hiring Travis van der Zanden, founder of the e-scooter company Bird, as head of growth, van der Zanden wrote in LinkedIn post Tuesday. Polymarket has a data partnership with Dow Jones, the publisher of the journal. In a statement, Coinbase spokeswoman said the company fully complies with applicable laws. In the letters, Menon posed more than 60 questions about how much the companies earn in New York, how many users were city residents, and how their marketing operations work, and gave them 14 days to respond. While the city council has no power to bring criminal charges, it can issue subpoenas forcing the companies to turn over documents, an authority it has rarely, if ever, used on a private firm. Menon said the council was considering legislation authorizing increased enforcement, public education campaigns, health measures, and/or the raising or redirecting of public funds to address prediction markets, and that it intends to hold public hearings on the issue. The letters came a little more than a week after New York Attorney General Letitia James sued Kalshi, accusing the company of illegally operating a gambling app. This suit is the latest salvo in a legal dispute that began in late 2025. Kalshi and other prediction markets say their business model differs from sports gambling because users trade against each other rather than against a house, more akin to an exchange. States can't just shut down federally licensed exchange, Kalshi spokeswoman Elizabeth Diana said previously in response to the lawsuit. In July, Kalshi made overtures to New York, offering a share of its trade revenue in taxes and volunteering to allow users to exclude themselves from the app, the journal earlier reported. What followed was a war of words over social media, with New York Governor Kathy Hochul attacking the company's bet on almost everything ethos, arguing that Kalshi markets for whether drug trials will be successful are akin to wagering on death. There are some lines you don't cross. Turning cancer patients into a prop bet is one of them, Hochul said in August 5th post on X. And it's exactly why New York won't let companies like Kalshi break our laws. This is a flat-out lie, responded Kalshi's co-founder and operating chief, Luana Lopes-Lara, less than a half hour later. On Tuesday, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, which under the Trump administration has asserted exclusive authority to regulate prediction markets, announced that it was exercising emergency authority in ordering Kalshi to continue to operate in accordance with the Commodity Exchange Act's core principles in the face of James' complaint. The New York State Attorney General does not set the rules for national derivatives markets, said CFTC spokeswoman Brooke Nethercott. That's the congressionally mandated role of the FTC. CFTC, as stated in the order, Kalshi is required to operate as normal to maintain market integrity and stability. Kevin T. Dugan is a reporter at the Wall Street Journal covering the culture of business and Wall Street. Catherine Long is a reporter on the Wall Street Journal's investigations team. She formerly reported for Business Insider, where she was a correspondent on the company's national desk. And here's a newsletter article, Risk and Compliance Journal. The Morning Risk Report, Judge Dismisses Adani Fraud Charges. Plus, flight tracking platform sues Kalshi over flight cancellation prediction markets. And trade groups seek to reel in FTC's AI ideology focus. By David Smagala. Good morning. A federal judge granted the Justice Department's request to drop fraud charges against Indian energy magnate Gautam Adani and his nephew. Risk Journal's Max Fillion reports in an opinion criticizing many of the department's leadership's stated reasons for doing so. U.S. District Judge Nicholas Garfus said Principal Associate Deputy Attorney General Trent McCotter failed to establish facts for many of his reasons for requesting a dismissal, but said he believed Adani's promise to invest $10 billion in the U.S. wasn't a factor in the decision. What remains in place? Garafas, the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of New York, left in place foreign bribery and obstruction of justice charges against the executives of Adani's energy conglomerate, asking the Justice Department to submit a filing by August 31st, better explaining their request to drop the charges. All charges against Adani and his nephew, Sagar Adani, were dropped. Response. Adani, in a social media post, said, I welcome the U.S. court's decision with humility and deep respect for the judicial process. Background. Adani and the executives were charged in November 2024 with allegedly orchestrating a scheme to bribe Indian officials in exchange for energy contracts and for deceiving U.S. investors about the conglomerate's corruption policies. Moves to drop the case. The department moved to drop the case in May, the same month the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission reached an $18 million civil settlement with Gautam and Sagar Adani in a parallel action. An Adani Group subsidiary also agreed to pay $275 million to settle alleged violations of Iranian sanctions levied by the U.S. Treasury's civil sanctions enforcer. Flight tracking platform sues Kalshi over flight cancellation prediction markets. Flight tracking platform FlightAware is suing Kalshi, alleging the prediction market company is using its data without permission to let users bet on flight cancellations. Kalshi has built flight cancellation betting pages verified by FlightAware's data, despite demands to stop, according to a complaint filed in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York on Monday. What do they allege? According to the suit, Kalshi uses FlightAware's data to settle bets on the percentage of scheduled flights that would be canceled out of an individual airport in a particular time period, and therefore whether those wagers will win or lose. The suit marks the latest legal action taken against the popular prediction site. New York City launches sweeping investigation into Polymarket and Kalshi. Trade groups seek to reel in FTC's AI ideology focus. Business groups told the Federal Trade Commission a proposed rule to scrutinize potential political leanings in AI content would impact everything from safety considerations to chatbot's sense of humor, Risk Journal's Clara Hudson reports. What's the rule? The FTC proposed the rule earlier this summer, homing in on AI systems for potentially undisclosed ideological bias and deceiving consumers. What's the uproar? Most business groups submitting comments to the FTC in response to the proposal said they are aligned with the regulator's goal of ensuring AI systems are trustworthy and support transparency efforts to help consumers. Some of those trade groups also attempted to steer the FTC towards a proposal the business community would find less restrictive. The U.S. Treasury's Financial Intelligence Unit is making permanent the exclusion of U.S.-owned businesses from its business ownership registry, Risk Journal reports. Investment advisor Eric Munson denied claims that he lied to investors about taking unsecured loans from funds, among other misconduct, but said he opted to settle a fraud case with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission to avoid years of litigation. New York Mayor Zohran Mamdani has fired a new salvo in his push to take on big business on behalf of low-paid workers, backing a bill that would force Amazon, FedEx, and other companies to employ delivery workers instead of using subcontractors. Water associations renewed calls for Washington to set minimum cybersecurity standards, arguing a string of disruptive attacks has exposed the limits of voluntary federal guidance. The Justice Department's fraud section, a prominent arm of the criminal division that investigates corporate wrongdoing, has a new name, the White Collar and Corporate Enforcement Section, reports Risk Journal. A Staten Island judge ordered an emergency pause on the implementation of New York City Mayor Zohran Mamdani's new pied-à-terre tax. Meanwhile, President Trump on Tuesday said he was reviewing whether his administration can challenge the new law. Austria's Directorate for State Security and Intelligence, DSN, dismantled an international network using shell companies and forged documents to acquire sanctioned industrial equipment for Russia's arms industry, the Interior Ministry announced on Monday. 76.9 degrees Fahrenheit is the average temperature in the contiguous U.S. in July, equivalent to 24.9 degrees Celsius, which was the hottest month ever recorded, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. U.S. forces fired on a Panama flag ship that attempted to run the American blockade of Iranian ports Tuesday early on, the U.S. military said, stepping up enforcement as the Trump administration attempts to squeeze the regime economically. A U.S. Navy MH-60 helicopter fired two Hellfire missiles into the engine room of the MV Villanova after its crew ignored warnings from American personnel working to enforce the blockade of Iran's ports, the military said. The cargo ship was trying to cross the Gulf of Oman for an unspecified Iranian port, the military said. Iran's mysterious ruler signals a hard line on Trump with new leadership. Gulf states accept a new normal in Hormuz. Iran is in control. Iran is defying U.S. pressure by becoming a survival economy. Insurance risks remain high as wildfire threat rises, Swiss Re Institute says. Estimated natural catastrophe losses in the insurance industry fell sharply in the first half of 2026. But wildfires and weather events still pose heightened risks, Swiss Re's research arm said. The Swiss Re Institute warned Tuesday that wildfire risk is the fastest-growing weather peril globally. Record heat and dry conditions in June increased the likelihood of an active European wildfire season, it added. July was the hottest month ever recorded in the U.S. A series of U.S. strikes on Yemen last year killed and wounded hundreds of civilians, according to an internal Pentagon assessment that was sent to Congress on Tuesday. Food companies largely dodged a regulatory hammer Monday after the Trump administration proposed overhauling how ingredients are introduced into the food supply. But trade groups representing makers of snacks, beverages, and dairy products also said the plan fell short of addressing concerns that new rules could drive up food prices. General Motors, stung in recent years by critical parts shortages, is setting up a $4.5 billion safety net designed to keep critical components flowing through supply chain troubles. Germany's top military officer said Russia is systematically using drones to probe European air defenses and find weaknesses to exploit. A Damascus court sentenced former Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad and other fallen regime officials to death for murder and crimes against humanity. President Trump has secretly flown out of Turkey last month on military jet after the U.S. government was told of an Iranian threat against the president and Air Force One, according to a U.S. official and another person briefed on the matter. Borrowers are delaying interest payments on billions of dollars of loans from private credit firms, raising concerns that defaults are higher than reported. South Korean conglomerate Hanwha has made a non-bidding offer valued at more than $1 billion to buy Astal's USA, a builder of ships and submarine parts for the U.S. Navy. Delinquencies are staying on credit records longer, pushing New York Fed measures of credit card distress to their highest level since the aftermath of the 2008 crisis. In the streaming era, when music revenue has become increasingly unpredictable, merchandise has become a crucial income stream for artists. Now bootleggers pose a bigger financial threat than ever, musicians and retailers say. Follow us on LinkedIn. Send tips to our reporters, Max Fillion, at max.fillion, that's F-I-L-L-I-O-N, at dowjones.com, Clara Hudson at clara.hudson at wsj.com, Yusuf Khan at Yusuf Khan, that's Y-U-S-U-F.K-H-A-N, at wsj.com, and Richard Vanderford at richard.vanderford, at wsj.com. You can also reach us by replying to any newsletter or by emailing our editors, Perry Cleveland Peck at perry.cleveland-peck at wsj.com and David Smagala at david.smagalla at wsj.com. And here is the Financial Services Roundup Market Talk. The latest market talks covering financial services exclusively on Dow Jones Newswires at 420 ET, 1220 ET, and 1650 ET. Hanover Re's second quarter net and operating profits beat expectations, but the results overall look mixed given that the company was hit by currency headwinds and its solvency ratio was weaker than anticipated. Keefe, Broyet, and Woods, Darius Satkausis, says in a research note, "Whilst headlines beat, we think there is enough for both bulls and bears to pick on," the analysis says. Net profits beat consensus expectations by 1.9%, with strong investment returns helping, he says. However, profitability at the German reinsurer's life segment was weaker than expected, and currency effects seem to have contributed to this, according to KBW. June and July reinsurance treaty renewals point to more volume growth at Hanover Re than at peers, but look weak in terms of margin, the analyst says. Adria.com Cataliud at WSJ.com. ABN AMRO Banks higher 2026 guidance will be particularly offset by increased taxes, RBC Capital Markets analysts write. The upgraded commercial net interest income guidance reflects continuing earnings momentum with higher forward rates, volume growth, and strong clearing net interest income, RBC says. While the raise is positive, it is partly driven by volatile clearing income, the analysts say. The forecast also includes 135 million euros from the acquisition of NIBC Bank. The impact of upgraded guidance on net profit will be partially weakened by higher taxes, the analysts add. The bank guidance for 2026 tax rate between 27% and 28% compared to the analysts' consensus of 26.6%. Strong capital generation means the Dutch bank is well positioned for capital distributions, RBC says. Michael.Hennessy at WSJ.com. The sell-off that followed SEEK's annual result and softer-than-expected guidance looks overdue at its bull at Citi. Analyst Siraj Ahmed points out that one of the drivers of the guidance miss is higher depreciation and amortization, which is a non-cash expense and only related to the job advertisers changing expectations of asset usefulness. Ahmed tells clients in his latest note that the volume assumptions with which SEEK has underpinned its guidance look more pessimistic than those made by its Australian classifieds peers, notably Car Group and News Corp-controlled REA. He thinks volume declines could be less severe than SEEK assumes. Citi has last published buy rating in the stock and target price of 18.80 Australian dollars. Shares are down 14% at 13.80 US dollars. News Corp is the parent company of Dow Jones and Company, publisher of the Wall Street Journal and Dow Jones Newswires. Stuart.Condi at WSJ.com. General insurer Suncor's capital management plan looks good to Jefferies. Suncor plans to buy back shares worth up to 250 million Australian dollars in FY27, building on some $400 million worth of stock repurchases in FY26. Jefferies analyst Simon Fitzgerald says this program is assisted by a $107 million capital benefit from placing aggregate cover and deferred proceeds from the early 2025 sale of its New Zealand life insurance business to Resolution Life. Suncor also said it would pay a $0.10 share special dividend on top of its a 0.52 share ordinary final dividend. Jefferies had a hold call at $19.75 share price target ahead of Suncor's annual result. Suncor ended Tuesday at $18.56. David Winning at WSJ.com. The size of Hella's capital return surprises Macquarie. Helia, which provides lenders mortgage insurance, said it would pay a 27 cents a share special dividend on top of its 16 cent share interim dividend. It also declared a share buyback worth up to $75 million. However, Helia have had buyback programs in place in the past without executing, says Macquarie. Indeed, the last time Helia actually meaningfully repurchased shares was in 2024, despite having a program in place until the end of 2025. Macquarie forecasts a $4 a share of total dividends over the next 5 years. It retains an underperform call on Helia, but lifts its price target by 5.6% to a $3.80 share. partially to reflect the capital returns. Helia ended Tuesday at a $5.74. David.winning@wsj.com. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take SunSounds with you. Get stream and on demand on our SunSounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear SunSounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. Energy startup raises $750 million for rust-powered batteries. Form Energy's fundraising has surpassed $2 billion for batteries that can continuously run for 100 hours, by Jennifer Hiller. A startup that makes giant iron air batteries that store enough power to last 7 days has raised a new round of funding valued at $750 million. Form Energy, which has now raised more than $2 billion in total, plans to use the money to boost manufacturing at its Weirton, West Virginia plant for its first wave of commercial projects, including a project for the utility Xcel Energy, in partnership with Alphabet's Google. Demand for Form's iron air battery system has accelerated with the upswing in demand for electricity driven by the boom on artificial intelligence projects. AI requires huge data centers which can use as much electricity as some cities. While conventional lithium-ion batteries can discharge power for a handful of hours at a time, Form's batteries are designed to last 100 hours. That's enough to help utilities power through days-long grid emergencies, such as winter storms. Form's batteries use iron, water, and air to operate on a principle it calls reversible rusting. The battery takes in oxygen and converts iron to rust. It then reverses the process, turning the rust back into iron and breathing out oxygen to charge and discharge the battery. Form's batteries would operate like certain natural gas-fired power plants known as peaker units, which can be relied on during a relatively small number of days each year. They tend to operate during the coldest or hottest hours when demand for electricity skyrockets and the power grid is stressed, said Form's chief executive and co-founder Matteo Jaramillo. We set out to commercialize the kind of energy storage that is competitive in all the features with a gas peaker plant, Jaramillo says. In many ways, what we have created is an e-peaker, an energy peaker. Form's batteries could also soak up electricity from various plants, including nuclear facilities, which operate continuously even if they lose money during periods when wholesale power prices plummet, said Vincent Khanna, investment analyst and vice president at T. Rowe Price. When you add a 100-hour battery, you actually increase the sort of value of everything else that you've already built, Khanna said. Investors in Form's latest round of financing include T. Rowe Price, Sequoia Capital, Janice Henderson, Franklin Templeton, TPG Rise Climate, Dustin Moskowitz, and Carrie Tuna, Kotu, and GE Vernova. Form has a backlog of commercial projects that jumped earlier this year to 80 gigawatt hours from 20 gigawatt hours. The largest, with Xcel Energy, involves installing 300 megawatts of Form's batteries to support the grid and a Google data center planned for Pine Island, Minnesota. Because the batteries can provide 100 hours of power, the system will be capable of storing and delivering 30 gigawatt hours of energy, the company said. Other companies signing up for Form's batteries include Crusoe, which is building AI data centers for Oracle, and Meta Platforms, among others. Whoso expects to use 12 gigawatt hours from form batteries starting in 2028. Renewable energy developer Future Energy Ireland is working with Form to build an iron air battery system in the northwest of Ireland by 2029. For much of the past 2 years, the company has been ramping up manufacturing in Weirton. Around 80% of Form's batteries content is sourced from the U.S., with the rest coming from Europe and Asia. "We have zero reliance on China," Jaramillo said. Form was founded in 2017 by a team of battery storage veterans, including Jaramillo, who helped develop Tesla's Powerwall battery storage system and worked on some of its earliest automotive powertrains. And Yet-Ming Chiang, a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, who co-founded A123 Systems, a lithium battery pioneer. David Kahn, a partner at Sequoia Capital, said Form has worked for years on difficult technology. "There's been this real shift in the venture landscape in the past few years," Kahn said. "AI has made it so easy to build software. Things that are easy to build are no longer valuable. And so actually, I think there's been a shift during the hard problems." While China dominates battery manufacturing, Kahn said he hopes Form will emerge as a national battery champion for the U.S. Jennifer Hiller is a reporter covering the power industry from the Wall Street Journal's Bureau in Houston. The leadership lesson Zero's CEO learned from a tennis legend, by Lila McClellan. When I spoke to Skinhinder Singh Cassidy, CEO of Zero, in early June, she said she didn't want to talk too much about the company's share price. Our conversation veered back to that topic a few times anyway. At the time, the New Zealand-founded and Australia-listed maker of accounting software for small businesses wasn't a market darling. Its share price was down more than 50% from 1 year prior, even though the company beat revenue estimates for its fiscal 2026, which ended March 31st. The drop was partially attributed to the SaaS apocalypse, but also to investor concerns about the impact of a 2025 acquisition, a move the company made to expand the business to the U.S. "The company is doing extraordinarily well," Singh Cassidy, a former Google and StubHub executive who remains based in Silicon Valley, told me. About AI and the company's AI strategy, she said, "We're going to be a net beneficiary." The market's reaction to SaaS's companies being completely undifferentiated, "That's a moment of challenge," she said. Spoiler alert, Zero's share price began to rebound in late July, following a leadership change for the U.S. businesses and positive chatter about the company's valuation, among other shifts. It's up nearly 12% over the month. Leaders have to develop a mental framework that can help them weather frustrating periods, and Singh Cassidy said she has found tennis useful in that regard. She rediscovered the sport during the pandemic. "It's a game where you can theoretically win less than the majority of the points and still end up winning the match," she told me. "When I'm down 3 games in the first set, what I think to myself is, this match is going to go 30 games. As someone who lives constantly in the future, like many CEOs, she also said, "The sport is probably one of the best things for my mind to just live in this moment once the shot is on." Then there was the mindset trick she learned from an 88-year-old tennis giant, Dick Gould, who was the men's tennis coach at Stanford University for nearly 4 decades. The CEO once took a lesson with Gould along with other tech leaders, she said. Gould was older and joyful, she recalled. "And I remember this point he said to us. He's like, 'Look, guys, every time I step into the court, I just tell myself on every shot, Relish the challenge. Relish the challenge. Understand how unique a position you're in and relish the challenge. It's a simple idea, she said, but true. Zero and Singh Cassidy still have much to prove to investors, and the CEO has more recently faced some scrutiny in Australia over share sales and high-profile departures. But she told me that Gould's three words came to her when she's behind in a game, or explaining the disconnect between the company's results and the market's perception to employees. She encourages employees to forget about the share price and focus on the work. It's very much a mindset of, hey, challenge is a privilege, she said. Honestly, being able to play the game is amazing. Aurora Cannabis to review takeover bid from rival Curaleaf. Canada-based Aurora is reviewing an unsolicited offer from cannabis company Curaleaf to be taken over for about $272 million by Dean Seal and Andrea Marchese. Aurora Cannabis is reviewing an unsolicited offer from rival cannabis company Curaleaf Holdings to be taken over for about $272 million or $4 a share. The Canada-based Aurora said Tuesday that it received letters from Curaleaf in late June and early July outlining a potential deal that it would assemble a special committee of independent directors to consider the current proposal. However, Aurora pushed back on claims by Curaleaf, one of the biggest cannabis companies in the world, that it had refused to engage in negotiations for a potential buyout. Aurora's lead independent director did correspond with Curaleaf's CEO, including as recently as July 24, 2026, noting that Aurora was focused on continuing to execute on its business plan over the short and medium term, and did not discourage an ongoing dialogue between the parties going forward, the company said. The response follows Curaleaf's unveiling of an unsolicited takeover bid on Tuesday that values Aurora at $4 a share, a premium of more than 45% based on Aurora's 30-day volume-weighted average price. Aurora said that the proposal caps the potential deal price at $5 a share. The stock traded higher than $5 as recently as last December, the company said. The courting of Aurora began in late June when Curaleaf's chairman and chief executive Boris Johnson sent a formal letter to his counterpart Miguel Martin. After Aurora declined to engage twice, Curaleaf decided to take the offer directly to its shareholders. We now take our proposal directly to Aurora's shareholders because the premium is significant. The strategic rationale is compelling, and further delay is unjustified, Jordan said. The $4 a share offer to Aurora investors is made up of 0.3463 of a Curaleaf share plus 75 cents in cash for each Aurora share. The announcement pushed Aurora's stock up 26% to $5.08 a share. That's $3.65 American dollars. The offer comes as Aurora grapples with mounting headwinds, especially in its Canadian medical and consumer cannabis segments. Fiscal first quarter revenue was down 8.9% to $67.6 million. Aurora's stock has also faced pressure, falling about 44% in the past year before the start of a trading on Tuesday. Jordan said the deal offers Aurora's shareholders an opportunity to participate in a more diversified global platform and increase their exposure to U.S. regulatory tailwinds. Curaleaf expects a combined company to generate $1.5 billion in annual revenue, nearly $350 million in adjusted earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization, and yield at least $40 million in annual cost synergies. By combining Curaleaf's global distribution platform with Aurora's leading international medical cannabis franchise and an EU GMP cultivation and manufacturing capacity, we see significant potential to unlock value through substantial cost and revenue synergies, Jordan said. Curaleaf cautioned that no formal takeover bid has begun yet and said that it wasn't a certainty that the proposed offer will ultimately be made. Dean Seal is a corporate news reporter for the Wall Street Journal in New York. And now here's an opinion piece by the editorial board. Trump jabs at vaccines for children. His executive order will feed public anxiety as measles is running loose. The U.S. is enduring its worst measles outbreak in years. But that isn't stopping President Trump from spreading vaccine skepticism. He overruled his advisors, press reports say, by issuing Monday's executive order urging Health and Human Services Secretary RFK Jr. to limit proven childhood immunizations. The president's declaration of gold standard childhood vaccine recommendations largely follows a much-disputed HHS report in January that advised fewer vaccines on the childhood schedule. Mr. Trump likes to paint a golden sheen on everything, but his proposed regimen isn't based on rigorous science or really any science at all. His plan for all children includes 11 immunizations, down from a recommended 17. Vaccines for measles, mumps, rubella, MMR, tetanus, pertussis, and polio would still be universal, but those for hepatitis A and B, dengue, flu, COVID, and rotavirus would be advised only for high-risk children, or else would be left to shared clinical decision-making between doctors and parents. The order also proposes splitting the MMR into three separate single-disease shots to be administered at separate medical visits. Mr. Trump claimed without evidence Monday that the MMR vaccines, in its current form, could be quite lethal. Is he trying to scare parents into not inoculating children? Breaking up the MMR shot would require changes in production that could take years. It would also likely reduce immunizations by requiring more trips to the doctor's office. Thanks, Mr. Trump. Thanks, Dr. Trump. Echoing HHS's January report, Mr. Trump claims American children receive more vaccines than those in many European countries. That's true, but the U.S. also has a more diverse population. Hepatitis B, which often spreads via contaminated drug needles and can be transmitted from mothers to newborns, is much less common in Western and Northern Europe than in the U.S. Many European countries with socialized health systems also don't want to pay for childhood vaccines for relatively rare diseases, e.g. meningitis, even if they can prove lethal, or even for more prevalent viruses like RSV and flu that can require emergency care. Regardless, when has Mr. Trump sought to emulate Europe? The president's executive order doesn't compel states or schools to follow his paired regimen, but he threatens legal action against those who don't adopt it. He directs Attorney General Todd Blanche to challenge state laws that conflict with parental authority, religious freedom, and disability accommodations and equal protection under the law. Under Mr. Trump's order, the Justice Department could sue states for infringing on parental authority if they require vaccines for school attendance that differ from his recommendations. State police powers to protect public health can sometimes be in tension with parental rights, and some states overstepped during the pandemic, though none mandated COVID shots for school-age children. In most states, it isn't difficult to get an exemption from school mandates, and in places, it's arguably too easy. All states provide medical exemptions from mandates. 29 offer exemptions for religious objections, and another 16 for either religious or personal reasons, according to the National Conference of State Legislators. Mr. Trump's order could inflame what has regrettably become a cultural war over immunization that has ignited by the Biden administration's overreaching. COVID vaccine mandates, and attempts to silence skeptics. He's also making the same blunder as Biden officials in trying to coerce states into towing his administration's line on vaccines. Mr. Kennedy and his plaintiff lawyer friends benefit from spreading vaccine skepticism. But Mr. Trump's jab at children's vaccines could alienate voters who are already souring on his second term. The other risk is more measles. Trump versus socialism. Which do voters revile more? The midterms were the Democrats to lose. With candidates like Abdul El-Sayed, they just might. By Jason L. Riley. When political candidates can't run on their record, they often resort to demonizing their opponent. With midterm elections less than 3 months out, this is the central dilemma for facing Republicans. Democrats want to make the November contest a referendum on the Trump presidency, while the GOP wants to make it a choice between the two parties' competing agendas. President Trump traveled to Nevada last week to highlight his second-term accomplishments, which include better border security and tax relief for working-class Americans. With the help of our Republican majorities in Congress last year, I signed the Great Big Beautiful Bill, Ms. Trump said. So if you're a waiter, a waitress, a bartender, a bellhop, a caddy, I love caddies, a valet, a hotel worker, taxi driver in Las Vegas, or anywhere else, anywhere, you pay zero taxes on your tipped income. The president complained that the press doesn't give him his due. I'm not getting credit from the fake news for what I've done. I've never gotten credit. And he has a point, but Mr. Trump's bigger problem is that a large majority of voters believe his stewardship of the economy has been subpar. The president blames Joe Biden. We inherited the worst inflation in history of our country. You got to remember that. Yet voters hold Mr. Trump responsible for current conditions. Inflation is down, but consumer prices are higher than they were a year ago, or when Mr. Trump began his second term. Unemployment remains low. But job growth has slowed and labor force participation has dipped to its lowest level in 5 years. For the first time since 2010, Fox News polls find voters citing Democrats as better on the economy than Republicans. The Journal reported this week, Democrats lead by 4 points on the question in April and by 9 points in July, whereas the GOP was viewed as the better economic manager by as much as 15 points in 2022 and 2023. During Mr. Trump's first term, his net approval rating on the economy was consistently positive. During his second term, it has been consistently negative. The president can fault unfair media coverage, but the press was no less hostile during the first term. The administration also errs, as Mr. Biden did, in telling voters that their economic situation is better than they realize. The 46th president insisted to the end that America has the best economy in the world, even as inflation-weary voters in his own party said otherwise. Mr. Trump told his Nevada audience that Republicans have done a great job in reducing prices, but inflation remains well above the Federal Reserve target of 2%. And the Iran war has increased energy costs, which redounds to transportation, manufacturing, housing, and other industries. A Fox News poll last month put the president's approval rating on the economy at 40%. Worse for the GOP, it showed that Democrats are more motivated to turn out in November and perceived as better suited than Republicans to handle income inequality, inflation, and health care. One of the reasons we're hearing so much about the rise of socialism in the Democratic Party is because the president's low job approval numbers make it difficult for Republicans to run on his record. Mr. Trump isn't on the ballot, but he will be on the minds of voters in the swing states and congressional districts that will determine which party controls the Senate and the House for the final 2 years of his presidency. Rather than fight voter sentiment about the president, many Republican candidates are happy to focus on the fringe views of their opponents and their party. For Democrats, the goal is to keep the focus on the president's unpopularity, but the party's nomination of self-styled socialists will make that difficult. In Michigan's Democratic Senate primary last week, the narrow victor was Abdul El Sayed, a progressive from Central Casting. Mr. El Sayed had called for single-payer health care, free college tuition, and abolishing immigration and customs enforcement. He doesn't believe Israel should exist. Ms. Trump and his fellow Republicans may be unpopular, but this is what voters want instead. The nomination of candidates such as Mr. El Sayed has smarter Democrats worried. He performed well among highly educated white voters, but bombed with those who were working class or black. Michigan is a battleground state with a lot of blue-collar and minority voters, and they could easily cost Democrats the general election by voting Republican or staying home. Republicans want to avoid an election that is all about Donald Trump. Candidates like Mr. El Sayed make that easier. Jason Riley is an opinion columnist at the Wall Street Journal, where his column, Upward Mobility, has run since 2016. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.